My talk is on OSU hand planter to promote precision agriculture for subsistence farmers. As already mentioned by Dr. Gerard in his presentation, how important mechanization is for conservation agriculture, for adoption of conservation agriculture. So with this presentation, we have a tool. By using this tool, we'll be able to promote conservation agriculture in developing countries. I want to start with world population. As you can see, by 2050, we are going to have 10 billion people on our planet, and most of the increase is going to happen in the developing countries, and where we are already facing with the problem of feeding the current population. So if we look at the production rates, the current production rates, and just focusing on maize, the yield differences in U.S. and least developed countries are 7 megagram per hectare, recorded in 2013. And there are some reasons for these differences, which include area of abiotic stresses, poor soil fertility, lack of access to fertilizer and quality seed, poor post-harvest management, and low level of mechanization in developing countries. Now, in order to increased production in developing countries, we have to look at new alternatives so that we can have food security, as mentioned by Dr. Philip. So one such technology or one such alternative is conservation agriculture, which aims to achieve sustainable and profitable agriculture and subsequently aims at improved livelihood of farmers through three CA principles: minimal soil disturbance, permanent soil cover, and crop rotation. And some of the economic benefits of CA includes labor and fuel saving, increase in yields, and reduction in soil erosion. And some of the environmental benefits are improvement of soil properties, increase of biodiversity, and reduction in carbon dioxide emissions, and also reduction in water contamination, landslides, and floods. If we look at the how much area is under conservation agriculture worldwide, as of 2011, it's practiced on almost 125 million hectares, with USA leading and closely followed by Argentina and Brazil. Now, if you look at the graph closely, there are most of the developing countries which are not even on the graph. And the reasons for this is because in order for us to promote conservation agriculture, we need planting tools which are necessary, because some of the current planting tools which are used in developing countries are mostly stick planters with metal tips, the different shapes and sizes depending upon the location. Now, in order for us to promote conservation agriculture, we need newer planting tools which are more efficient. And one such tool is developed by OSU. It's a green cedar hand planter. It offers a viable alternative to traditional stick planter for improving maize production in developing countries. It's ergonomically similar to the traditional stick planter already being used, and it reduces labor requirements, saves time, and improves efficiency. As mentioned by Dr. Gerard, there is being drudgery going on, like for women, they have to do a lot of work. And this planter, by using this planter, it doesn't require bending or squatting for planting purposes. So it definitely improved the efficiency. And it can be used in either conventional or conservation tillage. Now, design of the hand planter is really simple. Planter is pressed down and it compresses the internal spring. While the spring is compressed, the drum rotates and it picks up the seed from seed hopper. And while the planter is relaxed, the seed is dropped from the drum into the cavity made by planter tip. Now, in order for this study, our objective was to evaluate drum cavity sizes and planter tip. As it's extensively mentioned in the literature how important homogeneous crop stand is for better yields. For this, we carried out this study for 4 site years. We had Ephah, one location Ephah, which was under no tillage. Here we don't have the crop rotation part of conservation agriculture, but we use no tillage. And the other location was Lake Carblackwell, and it was kept under conventional tillage. The variables evaluated included drums, two different drums. As you can see, these two drums are of different sizes. As maize come in different shapes and sizes, it's important to have the specific drum for specific range of seed sizes. Otherwise, it will affect the singulation and whether the seed is going to be dropped by the planter or not. And we also try to look at different planter tips, as different users use different strengths, so it might vary the depth of seeding. In order to make it uniform, we put a well stop in just to have a uniform depth and see if it affects the final grain yield or not. We use two different seed sizes. It's 2,651 seeds per kg and 3,962 seeds per kg. And we also had a checks, a simulation of farmer practice, where we used a stick planter, and we made sure that we have 100% emergence in that. And we used a John Deere vacuum planter, which is currently used in U.S. and most of developed countries for seeding. It was a randomized complete block design. We kept plant population at 64,200 seeds per hectare. And we kept a uniform plant spacing of 20.5 centimeters. And the data that we collected included emergence, which included singles and multiples throughout the growing period. And we also took NDVI sensor readings from V6 to V10 growth stages. And we used SAS 9.4 for analyzing data. In my results, talking about EFA, which is our no-tillage site, I want to set up this graph for you. On the x-axis, I have my 12 treatments. The first two treatments are with stick planter, where I already mentioned two different seeds. And the rest of the 8 treatments are with the hand planter, where N is for normal tip and WS is for well stop tip. And two different drums, 450S and 260-20, and the last two treatments are with John Deere vacuum planter. Looking at the emergence data, emergence was fairly similar throughout the treatment. However, looking at the drums, drum 450S was slightly better at emergence compared to the drum 260-20. Looking at the singulation, the checks had better singulation compared to our hand-planted treatments, whereas both the drums did fairly equally at singulating the seed. Now looking at the grain yield, we had the highest grain yield recorded with the hand-planted treatment, whereas all the rest of the treatments, checks and hand-planter with 450S, they had fairly similar yields. Moving to LCB, which is a conventional tillage site. Looking at the emergence, a drum 450S had similar emergence compared to the check treatments. However, it was better than drum 260-20. Comparing the singulations, the checks outperformed the hand-planted treatments, and drum 260-20 was better at singulating seed compared to drum 450S with both the seed sizes. And looking at the grain yields were better with the checks compared to the hand planted treatments. However, singulation didn't affect it that much, and both the drums resulted in similar kind of yields. If we look at 2016 data, emergence were again similar, drum 450S was similar in having emergence compared to the checks, and it was better than drum 260-20. Singulation was still better in checks, and comparing both the drums, drum 260-20 was better at singulating seeds. However, there was increased number of misses associated with it, as can be seen in emergence data earlier. We had an interesting results in this side, which we never saw in the previous year. In 2016, the seed 3962 throughout all the treatments with this seed had better yield compared to 2651. However, comparing the checks and the hand-planted treatments, they had significantly similar yields. At LCB, that is our conventional side, we saw similar results. Emergence was better with drum 450S, and it was significantly better than drum 26020. Singulation, checks had better singulation, and there was no differences within the drums using hand-planted, within the hand-planted treatments. And the grain yields were similar throughout the treatments. There was no huge differences there. The overall conclusions we had that comparing two drums, drum 450S, resulted in better emergence over all side years compared to drum 26020. However, drum 26020 was better at singulating seed, but it was at a cost of increased number of misses, which reduced our emergence. There was no significant difference seen with the planter tips, either on emergence or singulation or on final grain yield. And grain yields obtained were similar with hand-planted compared to the checks. And planter performance was similar irrespective of the tillage. And some of the other significant benefits of using the hand planter includes that it removes chemically treated seed from the hands of farmer. As with the current practice, they use stick planters and they don't use any gloves. They use their bare hands and touch the seed that is chemically treated. It helps to decrease soil erosion while improved plant spacing. It can accommodate as mid-season application of urea, and it places urea below the surface, reducing the ammonia losses associated with the urea if we broadcast it. And it has the potential to increase third world meat production and nitrogen use efficiency. With that, I would like to thank my committee, Dr. Bill Ron, Dr. Randy Taylor, and Dr. Brian Arnold, and my fellow students in Soil Fertility Group and Department of Plant and Soil Science for providing the funding. With that, if you have any questions.
Thank you very much, Akhmandeep. And if you could take a seat, and I would like to call the other speakers, if you could join us up here. We have a 20-minute table discussion.
We are still working on it. We are looking forward to have them made in the country, but for that we need to have personal working with the farmers so that we can increase the awareness about the planter and their willingness to use it. Right now we have planters in Uganda and Nigeria, but still we cannot decrease the price. We still have that issue. Well, we, according to what we observe, we think it's all because of the planter performance, if that's the question. Because there can be soil factors, but what we looked at, because we compared it with checks and we saw if there is no emergence, we assumed that it was because that planter didn't deliver the seed. So we considered everything associated, like in comparing with performance, we think that that was because of the planter. Yes, it does affect. If you have a lot of moisture, then you might see some of the sticking problem with the planter tip. So you have to go at the field capacity so we don't have that problem. Other than that, it works really well.
Large-scale adoption yet. We are still the proof of concept, and the weather data, you can obtain it to proxy. Right now, it is in a proof of concept, and we have weather stations close to the sites where we do the validation. But the World Bank is investing large amounts of money in Bangladesh to equip Bangladesh with a network of Met stations. And I think if we're a bit forward-looking, I think we'll get access to high-quality weather data in Bangladesh within the next 3-4 years, I would say.
With the land potential, is that what it's called, the land potential? Would it be feasible to use the APSIS data, if it's for Africa? Are you familiar with it, where they have their information on multiple properties? What you probably would want to do is make a composite layer that would tell you the texture class, the soil organic matter content, pH that's typical for the area that's predicted from their models. Would that be a feasible addition or layer to your tool?
Yeah, so thanks. The question is, with the Land Potential Knowledge System suite of apps, would it be possible to use APSIS information? And the answer is absolutely yes. So the algorithms that we are developing now, and actually have some of them complete but haven't implemented, take the user's description. Well, first they take the location alone, and then based on basically some probability inferences based on where that is within the map unit, if we're using a map unit, sort of the source, it will predict what your soil map unit component is, in other words, what your actual PEDON or profile is. That then ties you back to the PEDON database, the Harmonized World Soil database of PEDONs that have been characterized, and gives you organic matter, CEC, base saturation, et cetera, or at least their best predictions. Now, what we're doing now, literally as of this week, we've shifted over to starting to look at soil grids, which is the one of the APSIS products. Okay, and there are some more refined APSIS products in Kenya and so forth. And basically what we're doing there is trying to figure out how we can develop algorithms that will take advantage of the APSIS predictions, which, for those that aren't familiar with it, basically independently predict every layer in the soil profile for every property, for every location, and these are 250-meter grid cells, which has some advantages and some disadvantages, and I'm going to stop here because we can get way into the weeds on this. But the short answer to your question is, yes, we're looking very closely at how we can optimize the use of existing soil resources, plus the user inputs, so you have a location, and then when the user provides an input, we have a much better idea of which head on we might be dealing with.
So, now, as we talk about climate-smart intervention. I'm wondering how you bring this together.
So I'm not sure I quite understood the one part. Were you saying that pigeon pea production was very low because of the competition from the maize?
So pigeon pea is very sensitive to water logging and drainage.
To water logging.
So whatever intervention you're going to make,
sure.
In terms of improving soil water status, because that's very
sensitive.
Very tough sensitive. You end up, having very limited numbers of pigeon pea, very low population, and then it's very disruptive. One plant has a patch, if you read it about quantity, the amount of biomass is then in this application.
Okay.
It's very, very low.
Okay.
If you grow it alone, of course it works.
Right. So I think that sounds like a very context-specific situation where you have that water logging, season-specific as well, where you have that water logging. And one of the things that our group has been doing is working with the geographers at Michigan State University to create maps about the pigeon pea potential and the suitability of pigeon pea, given the historic kind of climate record and soils that are there. And actually, Central Malawi, Sig was showing this yesterday in her presentation, that Central Malawi was actually ideally suited for pigeon pea, but people aren't growing it there, partly because of the market situation, and also then once the markets are there, they'll have to figure out how to control the livestock. Those have actually been more common issues. So people all over southern Malawi, in the southern region, are actually growing pigeon pea as a cash crop, and they're selling it for export to India. Likewise, in Arusha area in Tanzania, they're growing a lot of pigeon pea, intercropping it with maize, and they're not having terrible problems with, plant survival with, so it sounds like, Mozambique low-lying, I don't know exactly which part of Mozambique you were in, but definitely these crops need to be chosen for locations where they work. I know there are parts of Mozambique near the border with Malawi, where there are also very large, nice fields of pigeon pea growing. But I think the larger question that you're raising is there are no silver bullets, right? Pigeon pea is not going to work everywhere. It's not going to be the best thing. What I was trying to demonstrate is that what we need is honest assessment of all these technologies and looking at multiple sustainability goals and that are location specific. And so pigeon pea is not going to work some places. Conservation agriculture is not going to work some places. In some areas, it's going to have these benefits and other challenges. How do we kind of present that holistic picture and allow people to make informed choices? And that's what the indicators are trying to do. And, given there are different assumptions that are made, for example, in the modeling that was done with pigeon pea, we assumed those residues would get incorporated. And in the current livestock management, those livestock, when they're planted close to the village, at least those residues are getting eaten by goats and other livestock. And so we'll have to overcome that or, do it in areas where that can't be done. So I don't know if I directly answered it, but that's my response.
Just one more comment on the land potential, too, and then I'd like to switch the mechanization. But another layer that could possibly go into it is a composite from the harvest choice crop density layers. So what we did for a tool that we developed, we used 700 crops, each with their own density layers, and put it into one. So it makes our tool run much faster rather
do you want to comment on that?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's very, very good points, and I think revisiting technologies in changing environments is something that we need to do as well. It's not because a technology didn't work 10, 15, 20 years ago, or because there was no demand for it 15, 20 years ago, that we don't need to revisit. I mean, we are working in very quickly changing environments, and the demand on technologies might change very quickly as well. The business models is very important when you talk about mechanization. I think we have one project funded by ACIR now in four or five East and Southern African countries, where we have very interesting lessons learned. And I think it's not a project at scale yet, but half of the budget of that project is focusing on business models for mechanization, more than on the tools and the technicalities of things. Of course, you need to have the appropriate tools, you need to have the affordable tools, but more importantly is the business model. I mean, if you look at mechanizations in Africa and efforts by the World Bank and others, it was parachuting tractors and implements and usually inappropriate plowing implements throughout Africa. And, I've seen in West Africa, I've seen rusted tractors, rusted implements that were never used. There was, I think, some statistics about the lifespan of a tractor in Nigeria in the 80s or 90s was 30 hours. That was before the first oil change. So, because it was state-driven, it was, again, the business model of those things needs to be looked at. And I truly believe that there is high value for mechanization, whether animal drawn or mechanized, or truly mechanized, fossil fuel driven mechanization, beyond just the field operations. It's the post-harvest, the threshing, the transport, life-saving irrigations with axial flow pumps if you have access to surface water. All those type of things are just tremendous. And again, it will benefit mostly women farmers, or women in farming systems more than men. So I think it's worth looking at it. It's not something that we say we need to invest tomorrow $10 billion in mechanization in Africa. I think we need to develop a proof of concepts of business models and have lessons learned on those things before we just go and scale. But it's worth looking at it from a research point of view.
I may continue to this question. The challenge we have in Africa in fact is mechanization in areas where it's working, farmers will have to protect and enforce mechanization, then the research system is very weak is going to be challenged.
Yeah.
For example, in Georgia we have a leaf game system where the farmers are following the mechanization growth collectively in a big game. So what's happening now is farmers resist to diversify the crop access for wheat because they say it's not you bring in the legume a cheap wheat,
yeah.
If you have a crop by the harvest, I don't want to go back to farming ground in North Africa. But you want to bring to farming in the same. So now what's happening is that influence is now creating an approach for wheat and wheat business.
I agree, and that's something that you see all over the world. When you mechanize, you tend to decrease diversification in your farms. It's very difficult to mechanize in the crop systems, that's a drawback of the things. Again, intensification in smallholder farming systems are made of trade-off that we need to understand our lives and steer sometimes. So that's a very good point.
The residue maintenance issue is a very major one, certainly through Eastern Southern Africa. conclusions that are accumulated over a 2 or 3 year period of using these systems. Before you pointed out yourself that weed management make a 40-60% difference in yields in many of these systems. I know it's a difficult topic to deal with, but I come back to the issue of capital costs, cash costs, and say, you know, why aren't we taking a more serious look at herbicides?
Yeah, I agree.
In these systems, they're the things that need to stick in most of the conservation agriculture programs, but people seem very fearful of addressing the issue of safe herbicides in these environments. But the time lag to affect distribution systems are in place, business models are in place, the equipment is in place in most of these areas, yet it seems to be suppressed every time it is brought up.
That's not
huge impact on human structure in these systems, both at planting, fuel preparation, and in weeding.
And I agree 100% with you on the role of reasonable use of herbicides, and that's part of our research. I mean, when you look at systems, we don't envisage, we envisage alternatives, but I think herbicides is a very, very good option when it comes to labor demand, labor drudgery, and getting the most off your land for yields, because it's so penalizing if you have untimely weeding or poor weeding. But donors are not like you. I mean, just look at the Gates Foundation. That's the last grants from the Gates Foundation. It's, we couldn't tackle explicitly the role of herbicides or pesticides in general. So in USAID, for some grants, the same.
The same thing. But yep. It seems it would also shift labor utilization at those times to males who do most of the herbicide application.
Yeah.
And stimulate those service industries
you yep.
talked about quite. So why are we dealing with this issue head on with our donors?
I just want to add to that that we are seeing, I was a co-author on a working paper looking at herbicide trends in Africa using publicly available data, and we're seeing it increasing dramatically in some places. So Ghana, when we looked at the data there, as much as 53% of maize plots had, 80% of maize plots, 53% of all land had herbicides applied to it. In Zambia, it's much lower, but the trend is going up, and it went from almost nil to 6-7% of plots, and it is going up. So right now, because of this resistance that you're mentioning, farmers aren't getting trained. They're not knowing how to do it safely. And so I think it is a real concern. Farmers are going to adopt it, and the key determinant we found in our analysis wasn't wage costs. It wasn't that because the wages were getting higher, now it was worthwhile. Almost everywhere it seems like where farmers could access it and where they could overcome the cash constraint, they wanted to use it because it is so tedious, to do the weeding. So where agriculture is commercializing, like in Ghana, like in Zambia, I think we're going to see it increase dramatically. Yeah, it's up to 10% in Kenya and Tanzania.
The cost figures that you had up there for your paraboxin and your tool and prototractor, for the oxen, where did you go? What's involved in that cost there? And can you factor in like the progeny that would come from there, or the milk production? Does that figure into that?
Well, usually, I mean, in most systems you use castrated males for draft animals. In some systems you can use females, but there's no, you have the meat production at the end, but it's very usually very low quality meat because at the end of the life of working oxen, the feed requirements, the maintenance of the oxen, which is quite large. So whether you do cut and carry, whether those animals graze freely during the dry season, all those things are in that cost. So, and if you want, if your ox die and you have to buy a new one, that's the cost you would pay.
But the number you have there is $2,300.
Yeah.
So that would be the price to pay them or to buy them, and then the cost for a year.
I think that's the price. first, the cost of an animal plus the maintenance cost per year. Well, that's the value of the animal, yeah. Well, I think it needs to be refined, those type of things. And that figures were computed by a colleague in Ethiopia, and that's cost of oxen in Ethiopia. Tilau, maybe you have more information on that cost, you know, animal fraction in Ethiopia.
Yeah.
You need a couple of animals, you know, for your land preparation. You have 6 passes for this, and then...
Yeah, 1 hectare land.
Yeah, for 36 times.
So, I mean, the issue is that, you know, that ox will have to fight only 3 months, maximum 3 months in a year. So 9 months you feed that ox, you have to offer them for two. It's very, very expensive for farmers to keep the ox. And then that bigger, that the expense of the cows and the expense of the ox, you know. Data also, we work on mechanization, we work with spread cities and others.
Well, I think it's been a great discussion, but we've reached our time limit. I would like to thank you for participating in this symposium, and the meeting is adjourned. And people that are interested in being more involved in this community, we're going to have our business meeting right now, and you're welcome to stay and participate. Thank you very much.